You have before you the text that we're going to look at, but we're going to make our way, if you will, by going around the bush. I'd like you to think with me for a moment about what was most important to Jesus. And of course, what's most important is what he commands the most. And when you think about what Jesus commands the most, the thing that occupies his words more than anything else, you find that it's not perhaps what we often think it is. If you were to think about Jesus' command that he repeats more than any other command, many people would probably think, well, maybe that wonderful great commandment, love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, love your neighbor as yourself. And you'd be doing pretty good if you guessed that, because 8 times Jesus speaks of that in the Gospels. But that's way short of the 125 times that Jesus commands, do not fear. Fear not. Again and again, this is repeated by Jesus, so that if quantity is any indicator, Jesus takes our fears very seriously. And in fact, he knows that he has very fearful followers, and he has to constantly remind them, don't be afraid. He wouldn't have to command this so much if we weren't so prone to fear. And when we think of fear, it's important to note that fear always has to do with loss. And imagining, as Aquinas says, an imagining of a future evil that threatens the loss of something we love. So that when we think of losing our loved ones or our children or our parents, when we think of perhaps the possibility of losing them, we become fearful. We imagine a future without them. Or when we imagine a future where our health is diminished or we get a bad diagnosis, all of a sudden we are living in fear. Or if we think of losing possessions that we cherish, things that we value, if we lose those things, we have a sense of loss or a sense of fear. Which is to say that fear, when it comes right down to it, because Jesus speaks of it so much, is a deeply spiritual issue. And being a spiritual issue, it reminds us that fear is going to keep us from living the kind of life that God desires for us. Fear has the potential, in its fullest bloom, to rob us of faith. Because fear, when it rules our lives, makes life all about us. It's all about our own safety. It's about our security, about our self-preservation. There's no sense of denying yourself, taking up your cross, following Christ. Those are risky things. They involve a measure of suffering. But faith, instead of focusing on ourselves, is always inviting us outward to risk, to trust, to take a chance, to be bold, to give ourselves away in a way that sometimes our own self is threatened. So Jesus says, do not fear. And I guess what I want to wrestle with you this morning is, what does he mean by that? Because fears are natural. We all fear. So is he implying in do not fear that we should never fear at all? That we need to completely eliminate this natural human emotion? Some would suggest yes. One of my favorite names of all time, Shmuley. Shmuley. Shmuley Botek. If I ever have another dog, it's going to be called Shmuley. That's a great name. He is a popular self-help rabbi. I like a lot of what Shmuley does, but he's going to suggest in this reading from his book, Face Your Fears, that fear is never, ever, ever, ever good, and it must be eliminated. He writes, you must first abandon all thoughts that fear serves a useful purpose in your life. You must accept that fear is not only harmful, but evil, not only unhelpful, but deeply destructive. Fear has not a single healthy application in any area of life, period. Now, Shmuley is not saying anything different than what Franklin Delano Roosevelt said at his inauguration speech. Do you remember? We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Which sounds so good, doesn't it? Nice rhetoric. It has a ring to it, but like most things politicians say, it's not true. Wasn't true then. It's not true now. We have a lot to fear. There are genuine things that we ought to be concerned about. And thus, when Jesus says, do not fear, we can't assume that he's meaning that fear must be eliminated altogether, because there is a certain value to fear. So I would like to suggest there are two extremes. There is a wild recklessness where we are completely fearless, and then there's a smothering safety when our life is ruled by fear. To represent the wild recklessness, I have Dan Osmond. Dan Osmond was a speed climber. He did a lot of free soloing. You'll notice there's no safety gear on at all. He's climbing without ropes. This guy is a force to be reckoned with. He also did some controlled free falling, which is essentially jumping off a height and then recovering by grabbing onto a safety line. I don't know if that's the same thing as bungee jumping. I tried to look into this, but he holds the record at 1,200 feet. Free falling and then being caught by a safety rope. This is a guy that I would like to represent for us, a wild recklessness. And there's something beautiful about it. You have to admit, there's something that just causes you to lose yourself in awe that this guy is bold and wild and reckless. Until you recognize this. 1998, age 35, he was trying to do one of these free falls. It was actually televised, and the rope broke. He fell to his death. Now, at least he was doing what he loved, and I would like to suggest that I have a lot of appreciation for him, but for this morning, I'd like to use him as a metaphor of wild recklessness, and I don't think Jesus is calling us to an absolute wild recklessness when it comes to fear. But I also don't think he's let me set this up. This is an example of the other extreme, smothering safety. If you've seen the movie Finding Nemo, you know that the clownfish Marlin, the movie begins with him losing his wife and losing a whole nest of eggs, so he has one child left, and he commits himself to smothering Nemo in safety, to making sure nothing bad ever happens to Nemo. And because of that, he is a frantic, panicked person. He has no peace, because he's consumed by fear. And I'd like to show you one clip from the movie here. He's looking for Nemo with his goofy friend Dory. Now, Dory obviously has no fear because she's rather ignorant of all the threats that surround her. That's what makes her a delightful character, but yet one you wouldn't want to pattern your life after. But she does have a wisdom there. She's able to see that Marlin has determined nothing's ever going to happen to you. And I think sometimes some believers think that that's what God promises. I promise that nothing will ever happen to you. But Dory has the wisdom to know if nothing ever happens to you, then nothing ever happens to you. I mean, that's just not life. That's a prison cell. That's a life where nothing really good happens and no real growth happens, where we're preoccupied with simply survival and preserving our own self. That is the ultimate imprisonment to fear, that we simply won't live because any real life involves the possibility of loss, and therefore through fear, we just abandon any true life at all. I would like to suggest when Jesus says, fear not, he's not pointing us in the direction of wild recklessness, and he's certainly not pointing us in the direction of smothering safety. So what is he pushing us toward? And the answer is best found by wrestling with why wild recklessness is not what he's inviting us to. Because wild recklessness, absolute fearlessness, is not a virtue. Again, I'm reliant on Thomas Aquinas. In his Summa Theologica, he gives a great talk about fear and why fearlessness is never good. Because it's bought at a price. It's bought at the price of three things. The first is loveless detachment. Because you will fear the loss of nothing if you never love anything enough to fear its loss. So that if you live in a state of loveless detachment, if you never ever are concerned of about losing anything you love because you've decided not to love anything, then you can live without fear. But the fact is, you won't have any life worth speaking of. There are times in my life and times in your life, I'm sure, where you've had a brush with mortality, where you've had an accident in the family, or you've had a dangerous diagnosis, and all of a sudden the threat of losing someone or something you love causes you to have an increased gratitude for them. And you stop taking them for granted because you realize the possibility of losing them. So that those threats awaken us to the deep loves in our life, where we see how clearly we love and treasure the people and the things in our life. But if we want to be absolutely fearless, all we need to do is to be loveless, to not be attached or connected or bonded to anyone or anything in our life, which goes against love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. So he says the cost is too high. Loveless detachment is what we pay. We also pay with a blissful ignorance, not acknowledging or being aware of the threats that are out there. Some of my favorite movies are about stupid, dumb buddies. Dumb and Dumber, Bill and Ted. I could go on. I love those movies, and I love them mostly because these guys are goofs. They are clowns. They have no awareness of the threats that are surrounding them, and therefore, they luckily get through a lot of very precarious situations, not because they've recognized the threat. They're just idiots. They just happen through dumb luck to have got through a precarious situation. Well, eventually, life's going to get him. Luck doesn't last forever. And I'd hate to see that, you know, Dumb and Dumber movie where all of a sudden these two guys are, you know, horribly hurt because they've forgotten that you don't take on gangsters without being shot to death. That there are real accountabilities and action and responses that happen when you're ignorant. Charlie Chaplin, for some of you who are older, remember some of the Charlie Chaplin where he'd be walking around and buildings would be falling around him and he'd land through the window and he'd just kind of keep walking, or he'd be on the edge of a big pole outside a building or hanging on to the clock. There's a sense in which that's interesting, it's funny, but it's certainly not the way we want to live. So fearlessness is bought at the cost of loveless detachment, blissful ignorance, which will eventually bite us, or, and this is perhaps our favorite version, it's bought at the price of proud invulnerability, where we refuse to believe we're susceptible to loss. How many newscasts have we seen where people say, "I never thought it'd happen here"? I mean, these kind of things don't happen here. Which implies that if I have a safe neighborhood and a safe community and I got my retirement package all squared away and a good job, that I should be impervious, that these things don't happen. I should be invulnerable. But the fact is, no matter where we live or how we live, we're never, ever excused from disillusionment or fear or failure or sickness or poverty or even death. We just are not invulnerable to these things, but we worship heroes which are. And I get in trouble here. Batman is a perfect example. James Bond would be the counterpart to Batman. These people are fearless. Do you know why they're fearless? Because they're emotionally immature. They have no attachments. They have no bonds. They have no real emotional connection to anyone. So James Bond fearlessness comes at a price. We might be amazed that he's able to do what he does, but the guy doesn't know how to love anyone. He doesn't know how to nurture anyone or be compassionate to anyone or be kind to anyone. He only knows how to kill ruthlessly because in his mind there's an invulnerability. So I think Aquinas leads us in the right directions when Aquinas says, you know, loveless detachment, blissful ignorance, proud invulnerability, those are too high a price to pay in order to completely eliminate fear, precisely because instead of loveless detachment, we're called to love. To love with all our heart, soul, strength, and mind, to follow in the way of Jesus, to take up our cross. Instead of blissful ignorance, we're called to walk in the way of wisdom, to have knowledge, to think about things, and to understand the threats and the promises. And instead of proud invulnerability, we're called to humility, to walk humbly with God. So those prices are too high because fear is not all bad. When you fear, it's evidence that you love something. I fear the loss of my wife, my children, my health, my ability to think. I fear blindness. I fear a lot of things. And I fear them because all those things are good things. I love my wife. I love my kids. I love to be able to see. I love the ability to think. I love being healthy. Those are things I value. And because I value them, there is an imagining I can have of losing them. And fear is that very imagining. Not only that, but fear warns of danger. If a big bear is coming at you, you want to be afraid and run, or do whatever you're supposed to do to survive a bear attack. If the stove is hot, you want your kids to fear putting their hand on the hot stove. On and on you go. There's a sense in which Shmuley is a little bit off center when he says fear is evil. Because fear is evidence of love. It warns of danger. And it's just a natural emotion. It's a package deal that comes with love. It's a part of life. So since fear not does not equal no fear at all, what does it invite us to? What is Jesus saying when he says, do not fear? And I would like to suggest what he invites us to is to walk in the way of courage. Because courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is acting in the face of fear. Courage is the ability to realize that there is something to fear and I'm not going to deny it, but I'm going to act courageously instead. And so courage acts when it's afraid and when it's uncomfortable, which is a way of saying this. When Jesus says, fear not, it doesn't mean no fear, but it means act in spite of fear. Have courage so that fear doesn't shape our life. So that unlike Marlon, our whole life is not concerned about trying to have a safety and security that is not actually possible, and so that we will, unlike Marlon altogether, live for something bigger than our own safety and self-preservation. That we will live to walk in a way that faces fears, confronts fears, and acts in spite of fears. Because let's face it, if you wait till you're not afraid to face something, you probably never face it. It's just as simple as that. If you think that I'm going to wait till I'm not afraid to do something, you'll never do it. And so the call is to not let fear shape life. Max Lucado has some wonderful words in his book. I forget what it's called now. I'm reading a couple by Max. But he says, when fear shapes our lives, safety becomes our God. When safety becomes our God, we worship the risk-free life. Can the safety lover do anything great? Can the risk-averse accomplish noble deeds for God, for others? No, of course not. The fear-filled cannot love deeply. Love is risky. They cannot give to the poor because benevolence has no guarantee of return. The fear-filled cannot dream wildly because what if their dreams sputter and fall from the sky? The worship of safety emasculates greatness. No wonder Jesus wages such a war against fear. He wages a war. And I want you to see where his apostle wages that same war. If you look at our third paragraph down, Paul is writing to Timothy. Timothy is so fearful, he's been in tears. Paul says, I recall your tears and I understand how timid you were and you're young and there's a lot of threats and dangers in pastoring a church. But I want you to be aware of this, Timothy. Verse 6, for this reason I remind you to rekindle the gift of God that is within you. You know, bring it back to flame through the laying of my hands. Here's why. For God did not give us a spirit of cowardice, but rather a spirit of power and of love and self-discipline. Timothy, God did not design you to be shaped by fear. God designed you to be shaped by faith and to trust God enough to be courageous, not timid, not cowardly, but to have strength and power in the presence of God. So much so that you can face the fears that may even involve suffering like I have. And so Paul says in verse 8, don't be ashamed then of the testimony about our Lord or of me as prisoner, but join with me in suffering for the gospel, relying on the God, the power of God. Paul will go so far as to say this. If you come down to verse 12, he says, for this reason I suffer as I do, but I am not ashamed, for I know the one in whom I've put my trust, and I'm sure that he is able to guard until that day what I have entrusted to him. I have entrusted my life to God. And though I fear the loss of life, though I fear the loss of all that benefits life, God holds my life. God will care for that which I've entrusted Him with, so that I cannot lose if I entrust God with this. Therefore, I can walk in courage rather than being shaped by fear. Because, and this is where I think Shmuley gets it right, it's not that fear is evil, but fear never has accomplished any good thing. Nothing good has ever come from fear. Instead, a lot of violence and a lot of hatred and a lot of anger and injustice occurs because of fear. So that Max says this, "For all the noise fear makes and room it takes, fear does little good." Fear never wrote a symphony or a poem. Fear never negotiated a peace treaty or cured a disease. Fear never pulled a family out of poverty or a country out of bigotry. Fear never saved a marriage or a business. Courage did that. Faith did that. I'd add hope did that. People who refused to consult or cower to their timidities did that. But fear itself? Fear herds us into a prison and slams its doors. Fear never built a church. Fear never stepped out in trust to engage in a mission that involved some challenges. Fear never stepped out in faith. And that's why, since fear and faith are so at odds, Jesus will again and again repeat 125 times, "Do not fear." Because live by faith and be safe are at odds. We cannot love God and love our neighbor as ourself through fear, because fear will motivate us to do the least possible to save our own behinds. Where faith spurs us to generosity, to lavish love, to risk safety and security, to stretch out and reach out and face our fears in order to do the work of the gospel. So I think the perfect balance between that wild recklessness and the smothering safety is found in these two sentences. Hopefully this will be simple enough to communicate what we're trying to get across this morning. The mystery writer, Sue Grafton, this is from her book. She says, "If you're not afraid, you're not trying hard enough." That's the answer to smothering safety. I add this line to this: "If you're only afraid, you're not trusting God enough." So I added the second one, but you can see how those go together. If you're not afraid, you're not trying hard enough. You're not facing your fear. You're not acting in courage. But if you're only afraid, you're not trusting God enough. Because again and again, Jesus wants us to know the command that matters the most to Him, the thing He can't stop saying, it's like a broken record, is "Fear not, I am with you." Not to completely eliminate fear, because we'd lose love, we'd lose wisdom, we'd lose humility. But be courageous because of who's with us, and boldly step out in faith. God's never promised us, like Marlin did to Nemo, "I promise that I'll never let anything happen to you." That's not the divine promise. The divine promise is, "I will never leave you or forsake you. All that you entrust to me, I will not lose." So that we can risk all, because we cannot lose the most precious gift we possess, the presence and love and grace of God. God has made it very clear that God will always be with us. So let's take heart and have courage. Would you pray with me?